Hey everyone, welcome to Comedy History 101. This is Harmon. We have a very special holiday edition of Comedy History 101. Yes, it's part three of our history of John Belushi. That's right, we have two other parts if you want to go back and listen to them. But in this episode, we cover the making of the iconic Blues Brothers movie, which turned out to be a complete nightmare for Universal Pictures, but still manages to be one of the most iconic screen comedies of all time. But before we jump into the episode, if you like listening to Comedy History 101, let it be known. Give us a like, put a comment, subscribe. That way other people get to know about Comedy History 101. Also, we are an independent podcast, completely ad-free. So if you want to sponsor Comedy History 101, we're not going to stop you. You can do that on our Patreon page at patreon.com/CH101. Throw in a few dollars each month. We will buy new microphones. And without further ado...
You're stupid. Everybody's so stupid.
Good thing about doing comedy in Russia, you have captured audience.
You're stupid. Everybody's so stupid.
Comedy History 101.
John Belushi.
Yo, how much for your wife?
Dan Aykroyd.
After the gig, maybe we could, like, hang out together.
The Blues Brothers.
Are you the police?
No, ma'am. We're musicians.
Quite a trailer.
Yeah, dude. It's a big one.
Okay, yeah. What you heard there was an excerpt from the trailer of the classic 1980s movie, The Blues Brothers. And yes, you've tuned into another episode of
Comedy History 101.
Where we... What? School you in comedy. I am Harmon Leon. With me is Scott Colonico. Scott, I have a question for you.
Yes, Harmon.
When you hear the phrase, we have a budget for cocaine, what comes to mind?
Well, I would say first and foremost would be the movie The Blues Brothers.
Yeah, so The Blues Brothers is, you know, obviously it's a classic. It's an iconic comedy classic movie. It stands the test of time. It mixes music and comedy and action all in one. But production of The Blues Brothers, kind of a mess.
A little bit, yeah. Just to give you a kind of a heads up here at the front. So I believe it was budgeted originally for $12 million. The creatives, meaning like kind of Landis and Aykroyd, later on asking for $20, and then it wound up being, I believe, let me double check. The final budget wound up being $30 million.
And $3.2 million was just for the scene where Belushi and Aykroyd as Jake and Elwood are being chased by the army.
Yeah, that part is crazy at the end. But that's, you can see it. The money is on the screen.
Yeah, exactly. And we'll dive a little bit more into the backstory of that. But just to update the listeners, this is actually part three of not our three-part episode, our three-part series on the history of John Belushi. We've actually extended it to four parts the making of the Blues Brothers is a chapter in itself and a big part of the John Belushi story, because sadly, spoiler alert, 2 years after the movie was released, he was found dead.
Ugh.
God, why am I starting on a downer?
That's horrible, dude.
So, why? I know. Yeah. So in previous episode, we talked about the early days of John Belushi, where he got his start with Second City and the National Lampoon show Lemmings and the National Lampoon Radio Hour. And then the last episode was on his jump to fame with Saturday Night Live. And God, I mean, if you really think about Belushi in the public eye, he was just like 6 years, pretty much, was his kind of bookend career of being like a nationally known comedian.
Pretty much from 76 to 82. Yeah. Whoa. Right. Yeah. Nail, Nail Meathead, yes.
Yeah, and kind of his last year of SNL began his downward spiral. Like, there's that really creepy story that we played a clip from in last show where Jane Curtin said that at the height of his fame, you know, like on the last year, she would catch like Belushi going through her purse in the dressing room.
Jane comes across as one of the most level-headed people there. She was there at the SNL.
Yeah, and so again, and we'll go into this, and also with John Landis, who is the director of both Animal House and the Blues Brothers. Kind of Belushi's downfall was this a lot of enablers. You know, Jane Curtin told Lorne Michaels that, you know, the star, the biggest star in comedy, is going through her purse and people's belongings. And Lorne Michaels just kind of turned a blind eye to the whole thing.
Yeah.
Another thing that kind of fueled the frenzy was, you know, like Animal House, we talked about last episode. He would fly to Oregon to film Animal House, like, you know, Sunday to Tuesday, then fly back to New York to rehearse and do SNL. And then he got another movie offer, which was what do you think of when you hear the movie 1941?
Hey, sailor, want to help your country? Yeah, you out there, you in the audience, why don't you enlist today, right now? Forget about the fitting of your new zoot suit or the dance on Friday night or that strawberry blonde with a permanent wave. Country needs you, son. You gonna let her down? You think your best girl look good in a kimono, eating teriyaki off a straw placemat?
Here you go, Wayne.
I'd like to eat sauerkraut for the rest of your life.
I think of oh my God. Okay, so here's the thing. If anybody is there from Austin, we all regret the famous Austin VHS place, I Love Video. We had a bunch of locations in Austin. But anyway, well, I always think about this in I Love Video in their main headquarters. So it was Eddie Dietzen was the guy in 1941. He's the guy who had the ventriloquist doll. Actually, so in I Love Video in Austin, they would have an Eddie Dietzen shelf. Because that guy was actually in a lot of movies. He was in 1941, and he was in Grease, and he was in a couple more kind of big movies. And then after that, he became kind of like the nerd guy that people would hire. Mm-hmm. So that's what I think about when I think about 1941, to be quite honest.
Yeah, I've actually never seen it, but again, on paper, this sounds like it's going to go like through the roof. It was directed by Steven Spielberg. It was written by Bob Zemeckis, you know, from Back to the Future fame. It starred John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd. The premise was hysterical Californians prepare for a Japanese invasion in the days after Pearl Harbor. And it was a horrible flop.
Well, I don't know, the movie, I don't know, you haven't seen it. I've seen it. Got a few funny bits in there. I mean, not like, I think the thing is, it was like one of those things, if they would have not spent as much money on it and released it would have been okay, but like they spent so much money. Also, it was supposed to be it was a holiday movie. I think it was released and around Christmas time or something, and they were thinking it was gonna be a big movie. It was like, dude, who's gonna see it? Oh, let's go watch a comedy about 1941. Yes. No.
About the Japanese invasion days after Pearl Harbor.
Which kind of sort of happened. Los Angeles was shelled by the Japanese during a Japanese kind of U-boat during the war. But it was just like once or like one or two times. But yeah. But the movies got some bits in it, you know, but
But the thing is, it starred Belushi, and like in Animal House, he was just sort of a, you know, a secondary role, but, you know, kind of stole the whole movie. But here he was like a major role.
Yeah.
And much like in Animal House, he had to fly back and forth from New York to Los Angeles, you know, just sort of in a crazed schedule. And because of that, to help kind of fuel this energy, he began doing extensive amounts of cocaine.
Sorry, I'm just saying, in this movie, in 1941, they might say he has a major role, but if you've seen the movie, it's not.
Mm-hmm.
It's not. Like, he has, like, not that many lines in there. So it's actually really not a major role.
Oh, wow.
I'm just saying that.
I have to put Yeah. We need to do our 1941 episode.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. That's a whole another podcast. But like, yeah, that's definitely because that was how they sold it, that he was going to be a big star in that thing. But he's got, I mean, I think he has like maybe like 3 or 4 lines. I mean, he's not in there that much, you know, like Dan Aykroyd's in there and he's not even in there. He's like a tank commander. There's like way more people. Like, I think Ned Beatty has way more lines. So Ned Beatty from Deliverance is like kind of the,
yeah. That's how we always will remember Ned Beatty, even though he won the Oscar for Network.
His 7 minutes in Network, yeah.
Yeah, it was like a day gig, you know? He just came in for the day and did the one scene and won the Oscar.
But it's great. It's a great scene, man.
Yeah, it's a great movie. I love Network. Yeah. Paddy Chayefsky. But Belushi, when he started doing tons of cocaine to keep the energy going from flying back and forth to New York, his wife remembered Belushi telling her, "I don't know if I'm coming or going. Sometimes I can't even remember what day of the week it is." So apparently Belushi's lifestyle was a lot like ours during COVID.
Yeah.
We don't know what day of the week it is. But the movie was a big flop that Michael O'Donoghue, who we talked about in last episode, because he was in the opening sketch with Belushi on the very first episode of Saturday Night Live, began distributing buttons that read, "John Belushi, born 1949, died 1941.
Which would be impossible.
But a little creepy foreshadowing.
Yeah.
Because it was actually 1982 when he died. So after the success of Animal House, both Belushi and Aykroyd left Saturday Night Live, which helped kind of bounce into their next project, which was what, Scott? Which is actually the focus of today's episode.
It's a little movie about two brothers who are very much into the blues, called The Blues Brothers.
Yeah, raised in an orphanage.
Yes.
I mean, taught the blues by the janitor.
Yeah, I mean, it was great. Well, the great thing about this is that they kind of started on it when they were on Saturday Night Live, and they just kind of came up with this whole backstory to these characters about how they came together, how they met, you know, their whole backstory into the blues, which they wound up incorporating into the movie, which to their benefit, that's pretty cool. But when they actually came on Saturday Night Live, I mean, we're talking about like, it was basically 5 years between their first appearance on Saturday Night Live and then when the movie came out. And so they actually came up with this whole kind of backstory for these guys, which is like, all right, that's, you know, you're not going to get the kind of backstory on Larry the Cable Guy. And I have seen, I've seen Larry the Cable Guy in the movie. I've seen it in the theater.
One question about Larry the Cable Guy. His motion picture debut was called Larry the Cable Guy.
That was the one
Health
I saw.
Inspector or something?
With our friend, the podcast, Brendan Walsh. I saw him.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he was the health inspector, which is like, that makes no sense.
Yeah, so it should be Larry the health inspector.
I know, exactly, because he's not a cable guy anymore.
Just simple movie. It should have just been called Get Her Done.
Yeah.
Larry the Cable Guy and Get Her Done.
But you couldn't have done that in the health inspector because, you know, it should have just been Larry Get Her Done.
Yeah. Okay. But anyways, we digress. But yeah, like you said, a lot of backstory, so much so that Dan Aykroyd, who wrote the script, delivered a 324-page screenplay, which looked like the Yellow Pages.
Well, apparently, so I read another thing, and they actually said, apparently he wrote it out, and then they called the executive, Universal, because there's a bidding war between, it was a Universal and I can't remember the other studio, but there was a bidding war who was going to win it, so Universal won the rights to the movie. And then, so they said, okay, there's no script, so Aykroyd had to write the script, and then they called this executive at Universal. They're like, go out to your doorstep at 10 o'clock tonight, right? They just called. Yeah. So he went out there, and the script was there, and apparently, from what I read, it was actually wrapped inside a Yellow Pages, like a phone book cover.
Yeah.
We might need to describe that for some of our younger viewers, but there was a thing called the Yellow Pages, which was like the printed out internet. And so they just put, and it was thick. That was the joke. It was very thick. And so they just put the script inside a cover of the Yellow Pages.
And Aykroyd's original screenplay title was The Return of the Blues Brothers. And the writing cred he wrote was by Scriptotron GL9000.
Very Aykroyd.
I think you'd find that funny.
Oh, yeah. Very Aykroyd.
And their pitch was very simple. It was John Belushi, Dan Aykroyd, Blues Brothers. How about it? And that's what sold it.
Yeah, I mean, and the story behind it is pretty interesting because, you know, because Belushi met Aykroyd. They didn't really know each other, but they were, you know, Aykroyd at the time was at Second City, and Belushi...
Toronto. Toronto branch,
Second City, Toronto, yeah. So they met him around 1973, and Belushi was trying to poach Aykroyd to come work at the Lemmings and the National Lampoon Radio Hour. You know, where
as
Belushi
talked
was
about
one of the
in
yeah.
The first episode of our 3-4 part episode on John Belushi.
Yeah, but this is a thing with Dan Aykroyd. So they met each other at a speakeasy / bar called the 305 Club in Toronto, which was owned by Aykroyd.
505 Club. It was Aykroyd's
club,
bar.
Yeah, it was his bar. And the thing was, like, they had Aykroyd had a jukebox set up with all his, like, you know, all the blues stuff, R&B, B&B, soul, especially blues, Chicago blues, Memphis blues, you know. And then, like, he meets Belushi the first time, you know. Belushi, he invites Belushi over to this bar, and they're like, you know, Aykroyd's like, what kind of music do you like? And, you know, Belushi's like, I like hard rock and stuff. And
Bad Company.
Yeah, bad. Like, Aykroyd's like, do you like the blues? And Belushi's like, nah, not really. And like, Aykroyd's like, dude, you're from Chicago. You know, you've got to like the blues. So that was pretty, but like, that's kind of a thing with Aykroyd. He would just kind of either buy a bar. He would either buy a bar or have one erected. They had one. We'll get to that. But they had one erected.
Well, he has one now. It's called the what is it called? The Blues Cafe or whatever.
Well, he's got the House of Blues.
House of Blues. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah.
He's,
you know what? That's funny. I didn't even think about that in a line of all that. But like, so he had this bar. Then they had. We'll get to it. But then when he was working, when him and Belushi were working on Saturday Night Live, they co-owned a bar. And it was way down.
It was like the after hours thing.
Yeah, it was down in Tribeca somewhere. And then apparently when they were on set in L.A. on the Blues Brothers, they had the studio build them a bar on set.
Yeah. And the thing about Aykroyd, he was happy to be in Canada. You know, he had a bar. He was actually on a bunch of Canadian TV shows. I tried to find them like before Saturday Night Live. And in an interview, he said, I was making more money than the prime minister. So why did I want to leave Toronto?
Yeah, okay.
I think, trivia fact, I think his grandfather was a Canadian Mountie.
Yeah, I knew that. Yeah, he's got a Mountie somewhere in his history, yeah, in his family's history, yeah.
Yeah, so anyways, you know, the Blues Brothers came up through Saturday Night Live, but Lorne Michaels, you know, he first wasn't sold on them. He, you know, they would play gigs around town. He would have them warm up the crowd, but he wasn't, you know, really sold on them, you know, appearing live from New York. But he ended up reaching a compromise, having the Blues Brothers premiere on January 17th, 1976, dressed as what, Scott?
Oh, man, bees. The Killer Bees. Remember the Killer Bees?
Yeah, Belushi hated the Killer Bees.
Yeah, they
it was
were
like kind of
of
in the first season
yeah.
when Chevy Chase was the star. Belushi was reduced to just doing the bees bit, and he hated that.
The bees and swine flu. The bees and swine flu bits, man.
Yeah, because like he'd be walking around New York, and people would just go, hey, it's the bees guy. And, you know, this is like after Belushi was like a big star with National Lampoon. And then, Chevy Chase kind of just stole the show. The first season of Saturday Night Live. But the first time the Blues Brothers played was, and this goes full circle, when Carrie Fisher was the host of Saturday Night Live.
I'm soul man. I'm soul man.
Ha! Yeah, that's pretty cool. I've been researching. I still don't know what the episode is when they came out and played Soul Man. That was like, I don't know what episode that is. I will keep talking. We can cut this out because I need to find that out. Dude, this is ridiculous.
Yeah, so Carrie Fisher, as you might know if you're a fan of the Blues Brothers movie, also appeared in the Blues Brothers movie as Jake's jilted girlfriend who tries killing Jake. But in reality, she was dating Dan Aykroyd during the filming of the Blues Brothers.
So, yeah, that was like, what's going on there?
Yeah, yeah. But the Blues Brothers, what really kind of excelled them, as we talked about in last episode, Steve Martin asked them to open up a 9-night stint at the Universal Amphitheater in Los Angeles. The only problem is they didn't have a band, so they turned to David Letterman's best friend, Paul Schaefer, who was the SNL band leader, who kind of drew up a list of, you know, kind of the top musicians who were paid heavily to be in the Blues Brothers band. And they recorded the album Briefcase Full of Blues, which went double platinum. And as we mentioned, on January 24th, 1979, John Belushi's 30th birthday, not only was he in the number one movie, Animal House, on the number one TV show, Saturday Night Live, he also had the number one album. Did friends think that was a good thing, such as Harold Ramis?
No. We've talked about this. We've talked about this already. So just to Harold Ramis saw Belushi on stage when he had the number one album, number one TV show, number one number one movie in the country, and he was like, "Yeah, this is gonna go nowhere good." Just to follow up on that, Harmon, the first appearance of the Blues Brothers was January 17th, 1976, when they were called Howard Shore and his All B Band. And Howard Shore was actually the band leader from Saturday Night Live who came up with the idea for the Blues Brothers.
Oh, wow. And yeah, and Garrett Morris is sort of the hype man in their kind of first time on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
He introduces the band.
Yeah. So that was like, you know, it was like there's a whole... The whole kind of backstory behind the backstory about this. I want to find a little bit more about when they played that Soul Man. Because the thing that everybody thinks is that when they came out and they played Soul Man, that was 1979. So that was like 3 years. We're talking about three years.
Of just them making appearances on Saturday Night Live.
Exactly, yeah.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pie: People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Yeah, but anyway, so because of the success and the album, you know, they got the green light for the movie. And as we mentioned, it became a nightmare for Universal Pictures because not only did it go wildly off schedule, but also over budget. And a large amount of that had to do with the amount of cocaine John Belushi was consuming. So here's sad. I mean, again, we're talking about like, you know, kind of, you know, there was a budget for cocaine. Yeah. So as Dan Rackard said, we had a budget in the movie for cocaine for night shoots. Everyone did it, including me. John, he just loved what it did. It sort of brought him alive at night. That superpower feeling where you can start to talk and converse and figure out you can solve all the problems in the world. And he just said coke fueled his performance. As Belushi later said, it helped him be John Belushi.
Yeah, well, I like how Dan Aykroyd said, "Well, you know, I was doing it too." that's buried in there.
So that presented some problems because Belushi was aware that he had a serious drug problem and considered going to rehab, but instead chose to continue working on the film. He told his wife, "I'm fine. I can't stop now until I finish the movie. It'll be fine when it's over." Director John Landis, who was a teetotaler, you would think when you see the Blues Brothers that John Landis was just, you know, off his head on coke, but he didn't drink or do drugs.
Well, I mean, I think before, kind of just wanted to make sure that we mentioned this for the trivia nerds at home. So the interesting thing is that when they started, they're getting the Blues Brothers band together. They were talking with one of the musical guys on Saturday Night Live at the time. It was a gentleman by another Canadian, like Dan mm-hmm. Aykroyd, by the name of Paul Schaefer. Some of you might recognize from the head of the David Letterman's band, and also from the movie Spinal Tap. So, but Paul Schaefer was the guy who suggested all the guys to make up the Blues Brothers band, and Paul Schaefer was supposed to be part of it, but he wound up having, because he was actually on mm-hmm. SNL at the time. He was on SNL for a couple years, a year or two. You can see him.
Yeah,
he was
a cast member. Yeah, he was kind of a minor cast member. Yeah, I don't think he was like official cast member. Nah, I think he was like in the opening credits, but yeah, he was in sketches.
Yeah, he was in a couple sketches, and he had commitments to SNL, so he couldn't be in the movie. So that's just always interesting when you see old Mr. Paul. And then he dated Gilda too. He dated a couple comedian people.
I think he dated Valerie Bertinelli.
Yeah, and that means that too.
Mrs. Eddie Van Halen.
Maybe before Eddie Van Halen or something. Yeah, yeah, yeah. He was he got around, let's just say that.
Yeah, so there's this, I saw this like brief little documentary on the making of the Blues Brothers that just kind of focused on the music. And the musicians like all said they would get like this phone call from Belushi at 3 a.m, you know, without ever having a medium. It's like, this is John Belushi. Will you be in my band?
Yeah, yeah, so, exactly.
But there was a problem with the music. The suits at the studio had a problem with the music in the Blues Brothers, which, you know, it features the likes of like Aretha Franklin, Charles, and James Brown. They wanted more kind of like a disco kind of feel, a musical act. They wanted bands like Rolls Royce, who you might remember from the Car Wash soundtrack.
Rolls Royce, Harmon.
Yeah, instead of, thought like these older blues acts wouldn't appeal to the kids.
Yeah, well, we'll get into that because, well, they also thought they might be a little too ethnic, you know. So they
that was we'll also had to do with the release of the movie as well. And also, another note from the suits is they didn't want John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd as Jake and Elwood wearing their sunglasses.
Yeah, the whole time. which
they do, except for one scene where Belushi takes off his sunglasses.
It's actually pretty, it's a testament to how, like, you know, these people had this idea for the movie and they kind of fought out for it. I think it's like people say, you know, it is a mess, but in the end it kind of works, you know?
Yeah, it was known for at the time for having the most car crashes in any other movie.
That record was
broken by the G.I. Joe movie.
Yeah, I know, but it was a Guinness World Record, dude. Most car crashes.
Yeah, so even to the point, and this is also what made the budget go over, that they had a scene, they actually dropped a car from a helicopter.
That's right,
onto
dude.
The streets
the
of
Nazis.
Chicago.
Yep.
And how would we do that now? We would do it CGI.
CGI, dude. Boring.
Yeah, yeah. So they bought a surplus of old Chicago police cars. And they just
bought a bunch of old cars. Yeah, and I think they paid the thing that I read was they paid $400 for each car, but $400 in 1980
money. Yeah, 1979 money. Because the filming began July 1979, and it was initially shot in Chicago, and then they moved to L.A. Belushi and Aykroyd were put up at the Astor Towers. They got the top two floors on Chicago's Gold Coast neighborhood. And pretty much the whole shoot revolved around Belushi. So according to production, when Coke got the best of Belushi, production stalled. And when production stalled, they burned through money because they couldn't, you know, film. And Belushi was sort of the boss of the Blues Brothers, as Aykroyd recalls. Like when the band had a problem, they would turn to Belushi. And people just love Belushi. I mean, he could just get away with anything. Like this guy, Mitch Glazer, wrote a biography about the making of the Blues Brothers, said John would literally hail police cars like taxis. the cops would say, "Hey, Belushi," and then he'd fall into the back seat, and cops would give him a ride home.
Yeah, and then here, and it's the same thing. This is like, then they would have another bar. So they, I guess, they bought another bar in Chicago.
Chicago,
yeah, yeah. Called appropriately enough, the Blues Club, and then they would just hang out there, and that was like their after hours bar. But then people started people would find out it was like an open to the public bar, so people would start hanging out there, and you know, slipping Belushi all kinds of vials full of things.
Yeah, so it's just basically again like Belushi's kind of reputation was kind of like legendary, where he just had to live up to it, and just like kind of creepy hanger-oners would just throw cocaine at him because it was like, I got John Belushi high.
Yeah. You
know? So they would have a story. But I think like part of Belushi's appeal is like he had this like blue collar, you know, average Joe kind of feel to him. He was kind of like a Jackie Gleason kind of charisma. Yeah, so again, all these creepy hanger-oners were always trying to get, like, Belushi high, to the point where John Landis hired a bodyguard for Belushi to kind of keep him away from drugs.
Smokey, he was like Joe Walsh's bodyguard, too. Yeah, like, I think there's a good quote from Carrie Fisher at the time, and she's talking about the blues bars. And her quote was, like, yeah, there was some girl who would hang out at the blues bar. She cleaned out the fish tank and provided mescaline. There are all these people that were enabling the party to continue. So the fish cleaning tank woman would give you mescaline and coke.
Yeah, and again, so when Belushi was coked up, the kind of production stalled, and increasingly Jake sounded increasingly congested.
That is funny, because I didn't think about that until I read that, and I was like, yeah, when you watch the movie, you can
hear him. Sounds really congested?
Yeah, he does. He can hear his nose. He can hear it. It's like, oh, yeah.
Yeah. And sometimes he would show up hours late, or he shows up but would spend, like, you know, time in his trailer sleeping it off, and that was kind of like, you know, happening on Saturday Night Live. He just wouldn't turn up to rehearsal, and the ongoing catchphrase would be, "Where's John?"
Yeah.
But that was Saturday Night Live, you know, and then once the cameras rolled, you know, Belushi was on. But here he sometimes just wouldn't come out of his trailer. I think there's a story where John Landis came in and he saw on Belushi's table in his trailer like a mountain of cocaine.
Yeah, like Scarface style, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He said it's like Tony Montana. You know, and so Landis, like, he took the coke and he flushed it down the toilet, which was like, you know, probably thousands of dollars worth, and Belushi had a fit, and they got like into a shoving match, which ended in like both of them
hugs
in tears, sobbing and apologizing.
Yeah, yeah. So that was kind of, and actually at that point Belushi was like, yeah, I need to kinda, you know, something needs to be done.
Yeah, but like Landis was saying that it was just like a battle to keep him alive and to keep him working on the movie. Like they couldn't just shut down the movie and have Belushi go to rehab.
No, you couldn't have him go to rehab. Yeah.
I mean, again, it was like the crazy 80s. I mean, now that would happen. Like, again, it's like all this shit wouldn't happen in 2020. You know, you just like on day one, you know, Belushi would be in rehab. But here it's like, you know, we don't want the media finding out we shut down because, you know, John Belushi's done too much coke.
Well, they wouldn't. The thing is, nowadays, they wouldn't be able to start because they'd have to get insurance on him. And then, like, because he's a star. And they're like, oh, you're still on coke? Yeah, no, this movie isn't going. And we're not giving you the money to do it.
Yeah, there's one story that Dan Aykroyd told. Like, they were filming at night. It was like 3 a.m. somewhere in like deserted Harvey, Illinois. Belushi disappears, and on a hunch, Aykroyd follows his grassy path and spies a house with the lights on, and he knocks on the door and he says, we're shooting a film over here. We're looking for one of our actors. And the man said, oh, do you mean Belushi? And he came in here an hour ago and raided my fridge. He's asleep on my couch. So as Aykroyd pointed out, like, only John Belushi could pull this off, America's Guest.
Yeah, exactly.
So Aykroyd, like, woke him up. He said, John, we have to get back to work. Belushi nods, rises. They walk back to the set as if nothing happened. So at this point, was production right on schedule? Where they keep it to the $17.5 million budget?
As we mentioned, all right, that $17.5 million budget later escalated to a $30 million budget. So, no, we are not. We have not.
And then I think filming was supposed to wrap in August, and then it kind of turned into October.
Yeah, so it kept going, yeah. So they wound up being kind of about $10 million over budget, you know. And the thing is, they can't use a double. There's no doubles for Jake. There's nobody
Belushi.
Can double Belushi, yeah, yeah. They can't shut down the production. They can't wait for him to go through rehab, you know. And one of the executives tells Lou Wasserman, who is Lou Wasserman, who's like the head of the production. He's just like, Lou, there's a core problem. There's a basic problem with John Belushi, and we're not getting through, and we're just getting through with it. And Wasserman just says, just finish the movie, get on with it. And that is like the thing from every executive.
Kind of very just, not 2020.
No, just not very woke. Just finish the movie.
Yeah, and people working on it thought it was going to be like the biggest flop, to the point where they started nicknaming the Blues Brothers movie 1942. A nod to Belushi's previous movie, 1941.
I can get it, man. I mean, and those two movies actually kind of a lot like kind of in common. Belushi, Aykroyd, whatever. You know, Spielberg has a cameo in Blues Brothers. I don't know if you want to talk about it now.
Pee Wee Herman.
Pee Wee Herman, but it went before he was Pee Wee, kind of really. Paul Rubens.
Yeah, he plays like a waiter, doesn't he?
Yeah, he's just a waiter. Yep. He's in there.
As he did in the Cheech and Chong movie.
Yep, the Cheech and Chong. Yep, he's the same thing. Yep. I can't remember which one that was, but he's in there as well. But he was also that
Cheech. Yeah, he's Groundlings.
Yeah, it was all Cheech and Chong movies. A lot of the Actually, even in Up in Smoke, there's a couple Groundlings in that one, I think.
Yeah, those are good. Yeah, we'll have to do a Cheech and Chong.
Oh, Up in Smoke, dude. Up in Smoke's still funny, dude.
Yeah, just stoner guys.
Dude, can't go wrong.
Yeah, it's Cheech and Chong are amazing. Yeah, so, yeah, not only that, like, Belushi would just also do, like, just dumb stuff. Like one time they moved to L.A. to finish shooting, and a kid rode by on a skateboard. And,
yeah, this
and,
is it.
And
yeah,
Belushi was... asked to ride his skateboard, and he fell off, and then he just, like, destroyed his knee.
Yeah.
So they had a call, like, an orthopedist.
And this is the same guy. This is Lou Wasserman, who was, like, the head of, like, production at Universal.
Yeah.
And he calls the top orthopedist in town. He's like, hey, it's Thanksgiving. He's like, I need you to come out to go to work on Belushi. And the orthopedist says, no, it's Thanksgiving weekend. And I'm on my way to Palm Springs. And then Wasserman replies, he's like, nope, no, you're not. Not yet. So they pay this guy, and he fucking wraps up Belushi's knees, and they give him a lot of drugs, and then they finish the movie.
Yeah, and I don't know if it was like they shot last, like the music scene in the prison, but that's like a lot of dancing and stuff. So if it was that scene.
So that one, you know. So that one does, like we talked about this. So that one's got a lot of, I'm just bringing this up because you mentioned that. So this movie has a lot of cameos, and in that, I didn't even know this until I was reading. So in the prison scene, the first prisoner who jumps up on the table is Joe Walsh, the guy from, you know, guitar player from the Eagles, and also the guy who
shared a common bodyguard. Shared both bodyguard, off drugs.
Yeah, Smokey. Yeah.
Smokey, yeah.
Yeah, and the other cameo that I had forgotten about from Blues Brothers was Chaka Khan. She's one of the choir members.
And also, it's not really a cameo, but Henry Gibson.
Oh, Henry Gibson.
Laughing.
Yeah, he's the Chicago Nazi.
Who's great in, I love the movie Nashville.
Yeah, he's great. Yeah, yeah. Well, they're playing off, here's the thing, is they're playing off in this movie, in Blues Brothers, the Chicago Nazis is playing off that whole Skokie, Illinois thing, which
there was like a thing where they were going to go march through a Jewish neighborhood.
Full of Holocaust survivors, and then the Chicago, chapter of the Nazi Party wanted to do that, so they kind of incorporate, and that was actually not too earlier before the movie. So this is a couple years before the movie. So they like kind of incorporate, they wound up incorporating that into the movie. So that's pretty, you know. Why the story now. There you go.
Yeah, yeah. And then they drop the Nazi car onto the streets of Chicago.
Yeah.
Where Nazi number two says, turns to Henry, gets him as a point to their death. I have always loved you.
I know, dude, it's great.
That's a laugh out loud line.
Oh, dude, man, that's some. The movie is still good, you know? It's like, all right, you know? It's
You know, we kind of harped on just Belushi being a complete fuck-up in the movie, but, you know, you'd have to say that, you know, his two best movies were Animal House and Blues Brothers.
Yeah.
Hands down. I mean, yeah, the rest were kind of just flops. I mean, again, he didn't make that many movies. Because, 2 years later, he would be dead.
Yeah,
which we'll talk about, which is like, oh, man. We'll talk about it in the next episode, but there's just insane stories involving Robin Williams and Robert De Niro.
Robert De Niro, dude.
Stanton.
Yeah. I heard Dean Stanton's in there. Okay, all right. Well, I'll do my research on that. Okay, yeah.
Yeah,
the Chateau Marmont. I had cocktails there. Yes.
Yeah, right. It's right, you know, down the street from the Comedy Store, though, on the Sunset Boulevard.
Mm-hmm.
But so anyways, they wrap filming the Blues Brothers. You know, what happened? Was it a success immediately? Kind of playing at all the cinemas across the country.
Here's the weird thing, Harmon. So for a typical big budget movie back in the 80s, they'd book into about 1,400 theaters across the United States. And the Blues Brothers, they only booked into about 600 theaters. And a lot of the exhibitors, like the people who like show the movies, they were afraid because they're like, well, this is a black oriented movie. They were like, really like, oh no, this is going to appeal to white audiences. So there's a very weird little, not little,
racism,
there's a very, yeah, a little bit, a little bit of racism. And now, you know, to, like you said, you know, you want to harp on Belushi about being all fucked up. I was like, dude, these guys had a vision and they did it. You know, they're like, we want to make this movie about the blues, about the original people who are behind it. And they stuck to that, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, all those musicians are legendary. And if the studios had it their way, the music featured would have been Rolls Royce.
Rolls Royce.
Soundtrack,
car wash.
Who just a minor footnote in music history.
And instead, we get, you know, fucking Aretha Franklin, Cab Calloway, James Brown.
Cab Calloway.
Yeah, it's great, man. Maeve Butcher and then Ray Charles. Dude, come on. What's wrong with that, dude?
Yeah, plus, you know, the blues band, which is like Steve Cropper, you know.
Guys from a couple of original guys who originally played on the Soul Man record, guys who were in Booker T and the MGs, you know, guys who played in the Stax records, you know, the original, you know.
Oh, my God. Before we wind down here, what's your favorite scene in the Blues Brothers movie?
Good question. Oh, heavens to Betsy Ross.
I got mine.
Okay, you go first.
Where they're playing the chicken shack behind the chicken wire.
Okay, that's pretty good.
The road gig. Because it's like every comedian, like when we go on the road and we have the shitty one-nighter, we always refer to that scene in the Blues Brothers.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
we're practically playing behind chicken wire while they throw beer bottles at us.
I like when Aykroyd's talking about, they're like, how are they finding us? And he's got... And it's just very Aykroyd. He's like, they've got, they're sitting in the Bluesmobile, and he's like, they've got schemads. And Belushi's like, what do you mean? State, county, municipal, auto detection, you know. He's like ranting off this, like, you know, crazy computerized system that the Illinois county cops have. And so it's a very Aykroyd-y moment.
Oh, yeah. So here's something. So Aykroyd wrote the screenplay for Blues Brothers, and he wrote, or was one of the writers of the screenplay. I think he wrote the first draft of Ghostbusters. How come he hasn't written a good movie after that?
Yeah, we're not going to talk about Dr. Detroit, are we? That's going to be another. That's a whole.
Did he write the screenplay for that?
I don't know if he did. We need to get into that.
Good Devo song though, as we covered in the history of Devo on.
Not
on
that
Comedy
good.
History
it's okay. I'll go. I'll say it's okay. It's not bad.
I don't know. It's just funny.
Yeah,
Dr.
Detroit. Boop, 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 boop. So I'm just gonna like why the story now, Harmon, to end up here. So he said, you're in the States, I'm in Berlin. I just wanted to drop this in here right at the end here.
Sure.
So there's a open air movie theater across the street from me. This happened a month ago, 2 months ago, before lockdown. We can go see movies out in the open. So they were showing Blues Brothers extended cut. So there's an extended cut of the blue. Yeah. So when the movie was
What's in it?
Yeah. So when the movie was done, as we already mentioned, so the original script was 300 whatever pages, where a normal
324. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the normal script is about 120 or so.
It's like one minute a page.
About so Universal made when they were done. Universal made Landis cut about 25 minutes from it. So they have it's called the Blues Brothers Extended Cut, which I think only adds about maybe 15 minutes to it. And they were showing it here in Berlin, and at the open air movie theater across the street from me, couldn't get a ticket, dude. Every night it was sold out. I've seen the extended cut online. So there's a couple, and it's actually kind of, you know, it's all right. You know, I can see why they cut it, but like there's a scene where they explain why the Bluesmobile kind of has magical powers. You know, if you watch the movie.
Oh, yeah, it had like a bat cave under the Chicago. Yeah, yeah. Is it the Chicago train line?
Yeah, something like that. He's parking next to a huge, like, you know, power transformer. And then there's another scene where it's in the movie where Elwood says, I'm going to go quit my job. And there's actually a scene in the movie where he quits the job, but his job is working in a factory where he makes these I can't remember where it is. It's like some kind of pressurized gas and spray can. And that's why that you remember in the movie when he's in the elevator and he pulls out that can out of his briefcase and that's it. That's how he explains it, because he was working at this factory that made those cans. Because there's a couple scenes in the movie where he pulls those out. Yeah, so, I was like, oh, this is interesting.
So, strange enough, you know, again, Blues Brothers, iconic comedy movie. I think it clocked in at number 10 of 1980 as far as like raking in money, but actually kind of got some bad reviews up front. I think Washington Post called it a ponderous comic monstrosity. They declared it a epic disaster.
Ugh. I don't know. It's not that bad. It's not bad, dude.
No, I mean, it made $115 million, you know, after being released. But Belushi, when it came out, he would drive from theater to theater around New York, you know, gauging audiences. Aykroyd watched it in a movie theater in Times Square and noted he detected laughter.
Yeah. So I think Landis or somebody pointed out there, like, this is like one of the first movies for Universal that made more money overseas than in the States.
All right, so Scott, any other takeaways from the history of John Belushi's filming of the Blues Brothers?
If you're working on a movie, man, make sure you have cocaine in the budget.
Yeah, I don't think they have those cocaine.
Not anymore, dude.
Yeah.
Back in the old, that was the 80s, man.
Here. So that concludes the history of John Belushi and the filming of the Blues Brothers. We have one more episode on the history of John Belushi, which is kind of covers the filming of Neighbors. Which, by the way, just as a teaser, did you know Neighbors was directed by John Avildsen?
Yeah, kind of
directed
from Rocky.
Yeah,
I knew that. Yep.
And written by Larry Gelbart.
From MASH.
Who created MASH.
Yeah. Well, I've created
MASH. And spoiler alert, big flop.
Anyway, we'll get into it the next one. Yeah, I was going to say some more trivia, but yeah.
Yeah, so with that, it's time to plug away. Scott, what do you have to plug?
Oh, Harmon. Well, I have, and Harmon has, sometimes Harmon's on there, but I do. We do have another podcast / YouTube channel called This is the President, where we post all things presidential, all bits of presidential trivia and audio. Actually, just post Harmon, you know what? I just posted a video about the day that Bill Clinton saved Hanukkah. Have you seen that one?
Oh, no. But
no, it's crazy.
Was Hanukkah coming under attack?
No,
kind of
dude.
Like the war on Christmas?
Dude, it was like, it's even worse. You know what happened is that President Clinton invited a bunch of children into his Oval Office back in 1993, and one of the children's hair caught on fire from the menorah.
What?
Yes.
Was it Michael Jackson?
It was filmed, and it was filmed, and you can see that on the channel at youtube.com/thisisthepresident. We also do a podcast, and we'll have Harmon on. We're going to talk about this whole episode on the podcast as well. You can find that on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Last.fm, and everywhere you find your favorite podcasts. That's This Is the President on podcast and YouTube. Harmon, I've plugged away. Thank you.
Yeah, and as always, you could like, subscribe, and comment on Comedy History 101 wherever you get your podcast, or on our website, comedyhistory101.com. Also, sponsor Comedy History 101. We are an independent podcast, completely ad-free. So check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/CH101. Donate a few dollars each month, and we could buy new microphones and keep the comedy history rolling. And with that, thanks a lot for tuning in, and bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You're stupid. Everybody's so stupid.
Good thing about doing comedy in Russia, you have captured audience.
You're stupid. Everybody's so stupid.
Comedy History 101.